We're continuing our end-of-the-decade series featuring interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. Coming up, we'll hear from two composers, John Cage, a pioneer of experimental music, and David Del Tredici, who has led a return to tonality. I spoke with John Cage in 1982, back when Fresh Air was a local program broadcast in Philadelphia. The occasion was Cage's 70th birthday. John Cage has devoted his life to challenging our preconceptions about music and art. Cage studied composition and 12-tone music with Arnold Schoenberg in the early 1930s. But instead of pursuing Schoenberg's vision of a new order in music, Cage eventually abandoned the idea of order altogether in favor of composing through chance processes. He used chance-generated music to release his art from the limits of his own taste, memory, and emotions. Before we hear from him, why don't we listen to a piece that combines Cage's interest in Eastern philosophy, chance processes, and electronics. This is from Indeterminacy, in which Cage tells 90 stories in 90 minutes. The piano and electronic music score was composed and realized by David Tudor. Cage and Tudor allow the voice and music to collide and let the music sometimes drown out the voice.
I went to a concert upstairs in Town Hall. The composer whose works were being performed had provided program notes. One of these notes was to the effect that there is too much pain in the world. After the concert, I was walking along with the composer, and he was telling me how the performances had not been quite up to snuff. So I said, well, I enjoyed the music, but I don't agree with that program note about there being too much pain in the world. He said, what? Don't you think there's enough? I said, I think there's just the right amount.
If I may quote you from one of your books, you wrote, what was it that actually made me choose music rather than painting? Just because they said nicer things about my music than they did about my paintings? But I don't have absolute pitch. I can't keep a tune. In fact, I have no talent for music. The last time I saw her, Aunt Phoebe said, you're in the wrong profession.
Right.
Why did you choose, did you really feel that way about your music? And if so, why did you choose music over painting?
Well, my father was an inventor. And I've never thought that, as many people do, that music should be in my head. And that I should learn how to write down what I already hear. I really can't hold a tune. And I don't know solfège at all. So that I found ways of writing music to produce sounds that I haven't heard and that other people haven't heard. If I'd studied solfège, if I had a feeling for harmony, which I don't, I think I would simply write what people have already heard or what I would have thought I heard. The result is I have a curious feeling every time I write a new piece, particularly one for orchestra that involves so many people and so much trouble, you know, to bring it into existence. I think up until the last minute that maybe it's just going to be a great mistake or that we won't discover anything with it.
So you have to listen to your pieces as they're being done in probably a different way than most composers listen to
their work. I hear them for the first time, and I hear them with interest rather than critically. I try to hear what there is to hear.
So you won't walk away thinking, that was a real success, or that was a terrible failure, I won't do
no,
that again.
No, not that.
I think when you were studying with Schoenberg, and this is an indirect quote, he said something like, you don't have an ear for harmonies, and that will always be for you like walking against, like knocking into a wall. And you said, in that case, I'll bang my head against
right,
that wall for the rest
right,
of my career.
Right.
And a lot of your work hasn't been about that relationship of sounds to other sounds, but of sounds in and of themselves, individual sound, sound for itself. Is that too, do you think, from not wanting to work with harmony?
I had an interest in each single sound from the beginning. At first, I began putting the sounds together into, as I'd been taught, into motives and repeating them and varying them. But gradually, and through a study of Oriental philosophy, and through the use of chance operations, I have found ways I think, of letting sounds move from their own centers rather than centers in my mind.
What's your attitude towards random sounds in your home? I'm thinking now of...
I just love them.
Like apartments in Manhattan, which is probably the noisiest city
in
the world.
And Sixth Avenue is very, very noisy. And sometimes there's burglar alarms.
Oh, yeah.
And they may last 3 or 4 hours. That's quite a problem. I think that we almost have an instinct to be annoyed by a burglar alarm. But as I pay attention to them, they're curiously, slightly varying.
What if you're paying attention to something else at the same time?
Well, I think that one of our most accessible disciplines now is paying attention to more than one thing at a time. And if we can do that with equanimity, then I would suggest paying attention to 3 things at the same time. And you can practice that as a discipline. I think it's more effective than sitting cross-legged. I mean to say cross-legged in relation
to... In meditation,
you mean? Yes. It opens the... I think the meaning of meditation is to open the doors of the ego from a concentration on itself to a flow with all of creation, wouldn't you say? And if we can do this through the sense perceptions, through multiplying the things to which we're able at one and the same time to pay attention, I think we accomplish much the same thing. At least that's my faith.
You said at one point that your problems in your performances were becoming not musical but social, and that you saw composing as a way of instructing people's behavior, controlling people's behavior, and you wanted to get out of that. So what's the difference between composing and having people perform it, composing through like traditional methods, and composing through chants? Is it a different way of shaping someone's behavior when you're working through chants processes?
No. Chants is one thing, and working with music as though it were a social situation that was a desirable social situation is something else, and has led me to think of what we call indeterminacy. In other words, making my music so that it doesn't force the performers of it into a particular groove, but which gives them some space in which they can breathe and do their own work with a degree of originality.
You've like rejected taste and memory in the chance processes work. What's restricting about taste and memory for you?
There's a beautiful remark of Marcel Duchamp: to reach the impossibility of transferring from one like object to another the memory imprint. And I think the trouble with memory, both from a poetic point of view, is made clear too by the remark of René Char, the French poet, that each act is virgin, even the repeated one. To see things as being new rather than things that we already know before we're experiencing them. I think this is one of the things that leads to trouble between two people when someone says of another person, I knew what she would say, or I knew what he would say. I would hope that we don't get into that frame of mind with respect to one another.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because you have such a really rich and detailed memory and use it so beautifully in your storytelling and in your writings, which become your pieces also. Mm. I know that memory does come into play.
There's another remark I've come across in the last year or so that I like, and it's by the composer Erik Satie. And it's related to that remark that I just quoted from Char, each act is virgin. Satie says, experience is a form of paralysis. Do you see the relation? If we think we know what the other person is going to say, and if we don't approach things as virgin, then our minds and our attitudes to our life become paralyzed. And that's why we want to have each thing new. To realize that two Coca-Cola bottles are not identical. And what makes them not identical is that they're not at the same point. They can't be at the same point in space. Since they're not at the same point in space, they automatically receive, each one receives light differently than the other, so that it can be as fascinating as going to a museum to look carefully, attentively at two Coca-Cola bottles. And something of that is implicit in a great deal of 20th century art.
That kind of perception, I think, sometimes, like when you walk into a museum or a concert hall, it's like your senses get turned on because you're paying money, you're walking in, you're going here, especially to experience something sensual. Whereas when you go to work in the morning, or when you're going to take the subway or something, you kind of turn down a lot of those senses. You're not expecting a sensual experience, and you're maybe expecting things that you're not going to want to see or hear too much.
It's marvelous, though, when we are surprised by coincidences of light or sound and our presence. That's one of the beautiful things about hunting mushrooms, is that they grow up and are fresh at just a particular moment. And our lives are actually characterized by moments.
I think your life is like this great dialectic between things like between computers and the I Ching, or between having to know what mushroom to pick so that you don't kill yourself and your friends by doing the poisonous one, and then using chance processes for your music and poetry. Do you consciously decide which each of those will be, or do you just kind of naturally have those interests in
sides? We can tell rather clearly when we're in what the Indians call an artha circumstance, which is a circumstance where you have a goal and you don't want to kill yourself, or you want to win as in a game, or you want to cross the street without getting killed, or you want to hunt wild mushrooms and not kill yourself, and so on. That's one way of living. Another way of living is having and giving pleasure, kama. And another way is following the good rather than the evil. I think which is dharma in Indian philosophy, is very close to what in Christianity is faith, hope, and charity, such things. And then in Buddhism there is moksha, which is liberation from all those three concerns. And normally if we went to school, we would think, well, we start in artha, we go to kama, we go to dharma, and we graduate and get into moksha. But I think the truth of the matter is that we're in all four all of the time, and that we live a life characterized by inconsistency.
I like to think of you and Marcel Duchamp playing chess together, because here...
Well, we actually didn't play
much. You didn't
play? No.
Oh.
I played with Tini Duchamp, his wife, and he would criticize our game. And he said to me once, he said, "Don't you ever want to win?"
Yeah, did you play to win when you'd play chess?
I didn't then. I played chess in order to be with him. I wanted to be with him as much as possible. Now that he's dead, my game is improved.
Did you talk much during those chess games with Tini?
No, I had a kind of confidence that if I was just near Duchamp, that would be enough, that I didn't have to ask him questions or converse. Once I remember he said, "Let's sit down and have a conversation." We sat down and I don't remember what we talked about. I just liked being with him.
Was that so, that being with him and not talking got for you some of what you wanted to be around
for? Yes, I think his presence, his being, was both question and answer.
In composer David Del Tredici's press photo, he appears in a T-shirt emblazoned with the words "Tonality Lives." Del Tredici composes lush, lyrical, orchestral music. He studied serial music, but he began writing tonal music when he started writing settings for the text of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. His 1976 piece, Final Alice, is considered a breakthrough work in what's been called the return to tonality. I spoke with Del Tredici in November of 1987. We opened with an excerpt of his composition, In Memory of a Summer Day, based on the preface to Through the Looking Glass. It won the Pulitzer Prize for Music in 1980.
Air composers breathed was atonal. That was somehow, without anyone really saying it, the only way to go. And here I was suddenly writing long stretches in D major with very lush, romantic, Straussian Mahler melodies. This just seemed madness in a certain kind of way. Yet at the same time, it came out of my basic instinctual response to music. I was excited. This is what there was. So I had to, in a sense, go with that. On the other hand, my appraising eye saw that it was very much against what was acceptable at that time.
Which was what?
A kind of atonal, dissonant world. That's what modern music was supposed to be. Contemporary music was dissonant, as far as anyone knew. And no one anticipated the fact that somehow going backwards, that is, towards tonality, would be going forwards.
And when we say tonality, why don't you describe what you mean?
Well, when I mean tonality, I mean, in my case, really very functional tonality, the language of Mahler, of Strauss, the romantic vocabulary of chords that everyone is familiar with.
Now, you're also working on a commission for the New York Philharmonic, yes?
Right. In fact, that commission is a co-commission with the Royal Philharmonic of London. Yes, it is a non-Alice text, though it is a childhood poem, something called The Spider and the Fly by Mary Howitt.
Did the orchestras give you any specs when they commissioned the piece?
They just pray to God it won't be too long. Although in this case, Zubin Mehta and the Philharmonic have been most generous, and I said, can I have a chorus? Of course. Can I have two singers? Yes. Can it be any length? Of course. So they've been quite dreamy about it.
When you get a commission, do you have a day of elation followed by a prolonged period of panic?
Right, exactly. You sound like you've written a piece. That's it. One is thrilled with the idea of the commission. It's not so much panic sets in, but the long, arduous, quite lonely hours, days, almost years that it takes to make a piece happen. And I don't think people ever realize how much energy is involved in doing that and how, at least for myself, I can't do anything else. I always say, I can run my life, do all those things, or compose. When I'm composing, that's about all I can do.
I think one of the most difficult things for me to imagine is how a composer can sit at the piano and score for an entire orchestra and imagine an entire orchestra performing the piece.
Well, Terry, that is... You put your finger on a very fascinating, impossible, and challenging thing. Orchestrating is a very calculated risk. I mean, you're making a lot of guesses. I enjoy that. I mean, I could write for piano, an instrument I know completely, and know just how it'll sound, and that'll be that. But with the orchestra, there is a certain magical not knowing, which I feel brings out a kind of fantasy and daring I would not otherwise be prey to.
Now, you're working on a commission for the New York Philharmonic. Will the orchestra make itself available to you if you want to hear a sketch of a section that you're working on?
What a dream. Never, because the world of the orchestra is so expensive. You know, 20 minutes of orchestral time of a rehearsal would cost out of the blue. No, there is no time. It's not like a playwright writing a play and saying, I want to have a reading and gathering the actors together and sort of seeing how it flows and changing a word or a phrase or a speech to the here or there. That can't happen with an orchestral piece. I mean, I may take 2 years to write it, but the rehearsals will begin 3 days before the performance, and that's it. It'll suddenly be thrown into my face all of these thoughts. It's really quite a frightening time, and I often get quite physically sick during that first rehearsal, and I tell people, chain me to a chair and gag me and don't let me say a thing, because I've learned that with a great orchestra, in 3 days they can go from not knowing it to a superb performance. I mean, they're real professionals and they're geared to learn that quickly.
Have you ever gotten into a fight with a conductor about how a piece should be interpreted?
Always. That's part
that's why you want to be gagged.
De rigueur. No, that's part of the game. In fact, when I conduct my own music, I'm sort of disappointed. I have nobody to fight with.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Are you going to head back to your piano now?
You make it sound like jail.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Terry, very much.
We checked, and David Del Tredici is still at the piano working on his commissions. Tomorrow, we continue our end-of-the-decade series of interviews from the Fresh Air Archives. Richard Price reveals he's not Mr. Macho tough guy like his readers assume he is. Price's novels include The Wanderers and Blood Brothers, and he wrote the screenplays for The Color of Money and Sea of Love.